المستعين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. It's good to be back at UBC. It's good to be at the TMA. And I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that inshallah this coming year will be another successful and engaging year for everybody at the TMA. We start first with a lesson in ethics. One of the qualities of a believer is that he always has a positive opinion of other believers. So inshallah, we hope that if you're going to volunteer, that you're going to volunteer with a good quality as well. Now, it's been a while since we had the last session, and really this session is supposed to be a continuation from that session. I see some new faces, and maybe some of you who were there in the last session, you know, a lot of the material that was covered there was also forgotten through the summer. So today I'm going to be reviewing quite a bit. The reason I'm reviewing quite a bit is because the material I presented was fundamental material, not only that I need for today's session towards the end, but also for the next one or two sessions. And really, I know the question is it possible for us to know God? And even though I'm dealing just with that question, my purpose is not just to answer that question, but my purpose is to empower you with some of the tools that you need to be able to not only analyze that question, but analyze any other question that you also come along later on. Now, one of the discussions that we started off with last time was, is it possible to know God? Does God exist? And most importantly, can you prove the existence of God? This question is very important, proving the existence of God. Because there are some theists out there that will say that yes, we believe God does exist, but you know what? It is not something that can be demonstrated logically. It is but a matter of faith. There are some people who have that faith and conviction in the existence of God, and there are some people who don't have that faith and conviction in the existence of God. And no matter how much logical argument you bring up for them, you will not be able to convince them of the existence of God. So, the existence of God, is it something that you can prove logically, or is it something that you cannot prove logically? Of course, we believe it is something that you have to be able to prove logically. It cannot be a matter of faith, or it cannot be a matter where you say, you know what, I believe in God because, let's say, a scripture says that God exists. Can you tell me why? Why can't it just be a matter of faith? You can't understand it, you just have to have faith in it.
You should have a reason to have a faith.
Why do I have to have a reason?
Why?
Yeah.
Because it's based on the logic that...
Well, why? That's my question. Why does it have to be logical? Why can't I just go up to somebody and say, you know what, just believe in God, and when you do believe in God, and you have that faith, you will know that God exists.
Well, you won't, actually. But then...
Perhaps, yes.
Because God has always taught us or to question things, right? This may have become...
Now, that's a very cyclical argument, because you're telling me I should, you know, God has taught me this. I don't even know if God exists.
Okay, so yeah. I can just say, as human beings, we have a need to question everything.
Okay, yeah. Well, there are different arguments you can give for that, but one of the things that, you know, I could say is, the next thing you know, I could come and tell you that your God is a three-headed dragon. And you will say, well, what logical proof do you have for that? And I'll say, well, just have faith in it, and you'll come to believe in it, right? I could pull off anything if I don't base myself on logic and rationality. Secondly, why is it not enough to say I believe in God because, let's say, the Bible says so or the Quran says so? What's wrong with that argument?
They don't believe in the Quran in the first place.
Okay, yes. Same thing, right? So in terms of logic, what is that called? It's called a cyclical argument or a vicious cycle, right? How do you know God exists? Because the Quran says so. How do you know the Quran is true? Because it's the word of God. How do you know God exists? Because the Quran says so. How do you know the Quran is true? Because you can keep going over and over again, all right? So we have to be able to demonstrate the existence of God in a very logical manner. Not only the existence of God, but all the primary principles of our faith. The belief in God, the attributes of God. The existence of God is one thing, the attributes of God is another discussion. The belief in prophets, and the belief in the day of judgment or the belief in an afterlife, all of these have to be demonstrated logically and rationally. Now, there are many proofs for the existence of God. In fact, if you, you know, just Google it or you pick up some textbook, you'll see that there are about 8 to 9 different proofs for the existence of God. I don't want to cover all of them, and of course, all of them don't have to be correct, only one of them has to be correct, and that's enough to prove the existence of God. Inshallah, this week and next week, and not next week, but next month and the month after, we want to look at two proofs. The first one we looked at last time, it was known as, in Farsi, it's known as Burhan al-Naz, or Burhan al-Nazm, in English known as the teleological argument. Teleos meaning purpose in the Greek language, or also known as the argument by design. Some very important questions. I want to look at two things. The first one being one of the critiques that David Hume, 17th century philosopher, had towards the teleological argument, and also want to look at one of the arguments that Charles Dawkins has against this particular argument. That we'll look at today, partially. And then the other argument for the existence of God, a more powerful argument, which answers a very important question, and I'll bring up that question towards the end of today's session, is known as the Burhan of Imkan and Wujud. The argument of necessary and contingent beings. One of the objections raised by Bertrand Russell, 20th century English philosopher, against the existence of God is answered by understanding the argument of necessary and contingent beings. However, whether you're looking at this particular argument or you're looking at this particular argument, both of these arguments are demonstrated using one particular philosophical tool. And that philosophical tool, or logical tool, is known as a syllogism. Anybody know what the word for a syllogism is in Arabic? Or in Farsi? If A is B and B is C, then A is C. What do you call that in Arabic?
Tasalsul.
That's a chain. And if C is D, B is D, okay. Now, syllogism in Arabic is known as a qiyas, or even in Farsi. But this word qiyas sometimes is used in mantiq, and sometimes the word qiyas is used in fiqh. And in both those areas, they mean completely different things. For example, you hear some ahadith where we say, we don't accept qiyas. Qiyas is not from, you know, our practices. They're not talking about syllogisms. They're talking about something completely different. Oh, when we talk about syllogisms, we're talking about syllogisms or qiyas in the mantiqi sense. A very simple example of it is, you know, if A is B and B is C, then A is C. All right? So, for example, the classical example they'll give you in the textbooks is, you know, Socrates is a human being. Every human being is mortal. Therefore, Socrates is mortal as well, right? Now, coming to a syllogism, there are three things in this particular syllogism that have to be valid for the conclusion to be correct. Can you tell me what those three things are? Now, this is known as the minor premise. This is known as the major premise. And this is known as the conclusion. For the conclusion to be valid, three things have to be valid.
Minor, major.
Okay, good. So minor premise must be valid. The major premise must be valid. What else must be valid?
Everything should exist. Should have A, B, and C.
Socrates was human. I am human. I am Socrates. What's wrong with that argument?
Conclusion has to be true.
Sorry?
Conclusion has to be true.
Well, yeah, but what makes the conclusion wrong in this case?
Do you mean true or valid when you're speaking of the premises being valid?
Well, if the if the premises are true, okay, and if the premises are true, the conclusion is true as well. Premises are not true, but something else is true, the conclusion is valid for those premises.
Yes.
So one is, yes, correct, minor premise must be valid, major premise must be valid, and also the form of the argument must be valid. A is B, B is C, therefore A is C. When I say, Socrates was human, I am Socrates, the problem was what? The major premise was correct, the minor premise was correct, but the problem was in the form of the argument. So the form must be valid as well. Brings us to a very important conclusion over here. Every argument has what we call a madda, a substance, the content of the argument, and every argument also has a surah, which we call the form of the argument. For the argument to be conclusive and valid and true, the substance has to be valid, the form also has to be valid. All right. Now, we also say one more thing before we move on. We say that there are two areas of study. The first one is mantiq. Mantiq means logic. Traditionally, in the system of the Hawza or in Islamic classical teachings, there was mantiq, and mantiq told you which forms are valid and which forms are not valid. You only see one form over here. I can make 16 different forms using four of the or three of the variables that I have on there. Which forms are valid, which forms are not valid. Mantiq looks into that. But then there's also another field of study that doesn't look at the form of the argument, but rather looks at the content of the argument. How do you know that the content is valid? And that field of study was called?
Not falsafa.
Yeah, it's a particular aspect of falsafa. It was called? Ma'rifat Shinasi, or in English known as epistemology. Epistemology. Now, I do have the notes from last time. Would you like me to give them out for you to follow?
Okay.
Now, you do know when you're tired, you print the same page on both sides, so just forgive that. Okay? What we'll do is I'll drop a couple here. And I don't even know what happened here. Yeah, it says two pages, so. You know what? Let me just put it apart. These two.
I still need a second page.
You need a second page. This one's your copy. Alright, now the notes are not in any particular order. I have reviewed the notes, so I'm presenting with a different order, but in case you go home and you're wondering what I was blabbering about, then you can read those notes and you would understand, hopefully. Alright, one more thing before we move on to today's discussion is we also say, in terms of the content which is valid, we say a premise is valid if it is made of valid arguments or it is itself self-evident. Alright? So for example, if I have a premise, an argument, I can prove it usually using an argument. A is B, B is C. It is the conclusion of an argument. But not all premises are like that. And they can't all be like that, right? Because you have an argument, you rely upon, let's say, a syllogism to prove that argument. That syllogism has two premises in it. Suppose those two premises are proven using two other syllogisms. At some point, as you go back down the chain, it has to stop somewhere where the premises are not proven using syllogisms. Rather, those premises are your building blocks. in mathematics, you call them your axioms, right? Your primary premises, which don't have an argument to prove them. They're just self-evident. Now, these self-evident arguments, according to logicians like Aristotle and Ibn Sina and Farabi, they say they are of five types. I don't think you have these in your notes, but you might just want to quickly make a point of them. Four and five. They say some of them are known as primary premises. What you call in Arabic, abadiyat. This is a premise. Or badihiyat. This is a premise where you think about the subject, you think about the predicate, and you come to realize this has to be right. It doesn't need an argument. For example, the law of contradiction. This particular cap that I have cannot all be black and all be white at the same time. I dare you to bring up a syllogism to prove that. You can't. It's one of the most primary building blocks of all knowledge that we have. And it's something that you just, the moment you think about it, you come to realize, you know what? This has got to be correct. Okay? That's a primary premise. Second example that they give us is something that they call a fitriyat. Innate premises. Sometimes they're known as hadasiyat as well. A strong educated guess. So strong that you become sure this has got to be correct. The example they give is an interesting example. You know Khwaja Nasiruddin At-Tusi. Alright? Khwaja Nasiruddin At-Tusi was a great scholar, great philosopher, great ethicist, but also a wonderful mathematician and a wonderful astronomer as well, and a politician at the same time. We hear that Khwaja Nasiruddin At-Tusi got the Mongols, who destroyed the library of Baghdad and burned it down, he got those Mongols to commission and pay for his astrolabe that he had, that is located somewhere in the Maraghah astrolabe. Exactly, that one, right? Now, from the Maraghah astrolabe, sometimes they used to look out at sea. And when they would look out at sea, they would see when the ships are coming in, first you see the mast, and slowly you start to see the rest of the body. It wasn't the case that you saw the whole ship, a small, size of it, and then as it came closer, you start to see it bigger and bigger. From that, they came to realize that the curvature of the earth is not flat, because if it was flat, you would see the whole ship, small size, and as it came closer, the whole ship, a bigger size. Rather, it is curved, and that's why you first see the mast, and you don't see the rest of the body, and as it comes closer to you, you start seeing the rest of the body. Now, when they looked out at sea and they saw this, they came to quickly realize within themselves that, you know what, this is a curve, a surface, and not a flat surface, all right? Now, this is one of those fitriyat or hadasiyat. The third is something which is empirical. Empirical, right? So, for example, when I look and I see this cap, it is black. There's no syllogism to prove that. With my eyes, I saw it is black. Or when I touch a piece and it's hot, there's no argument for it. Empirically, using one of the five senses, I came to know that this is hot, or this is red, or this is loud, or this is what they were saying, for example. The fourth one, and this is the most important one for me today, is something which is experimental. Also known as tajrubiyat. All of science is based on this. If you can't accept that using experimental knowledge we can know the world, then even science comes into question. What's something that's experimental? Empirically, you observe two things happening over and over again. You observe a cause and you observe an effect. Repetitively, you come to the conclusion that this is the cause of this effect. For example, empirically, you take different types of metals and you put them close to a fire or close to a heat source, and you come to realize that the metal expands, right? When you do that over and over again, 100 times, you come to the conclusion that heat causes metals to expand. Where does that conclusion come from? Is it an avaliyat, a primary premise? Of course not. You have to experiment. Is it a fitriyat? No, it isn't a fitriyat. Is it empirical? Well, part of it is empirical. You had to observe it for yourself, but one-time observation wasn't enough. You had to repeat it over and over again to come across this conclusion, all right? the cause, now listen to this very carefully, the cause has to be observed empirically, the effect has to be observed empirically, and the relationship has to be observed over and over, repetitively, for you to come to the conclusion that, you know, this premise is valid, that heat causes metals to expand, for example. And the last one is unanimity. Unanimity can also bring about certainty within a premise. Right? For example, a guy walks in and says there was an explosion near the, the CB building. All right. One person comes and says it to you, you don't believe it. An explosion here at UBC, which terrorist would want to target UBC? All right. And then another person comes in and says there was an explosion. You go, okay, there's a greater probability, a 60% chance. How about if 20 independent people came and told you there was an explosion near the CME building? At that point, you start believing in the premise that there was an explosion at the CME building. All right, so about 5 of them in total. But the most important one for me for today, this one, and this one, and this one. All right, are we clear on this so far? That's a very quick review. All right, awesome. Now, coming back to the argument that we wanted to demonstrate today, the argument was known as the argument by design. And before we start this argument by design, I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you that the argument by design is formulated using one syllogism, whereas the argument we look at next month, which is known as the argument of contingent and necessary beings, is formulated using two syllogisms. So today we're only looking at one syllogism. And before I get into that, many of you have heard of this argument by design, right? You say, look at the world around you, it's such a design structure, therefore it proves that there must be a designer who designed this design structure. First thing, tell me, what's the purpose and the goal of this argument of by design? What do we want to prove? In simple words, we want to prove that there is a
creator.
There is a creator, right? What I found interesting is that also atheists believe that there is a creator. And they call it Mother Nature, for example. Or they call it evolution, for example. So what's the difference between our belief and their belief?
There is intellectual creation.
Excellent. There is a sentient designer. There is a designer that has thought, that has its own will, that thinks for itself, that's an intelligent designer, and not just any mechanism that brings things into creation. So first thing that's very important to recognize, the goal in this argument by design is not just to prove the existence of a creator, rather to prove the existence of a sentient creator. And you had a question.
No, I just had a comment. Isn't it like the second thing that we believe in is that the existence of a wajib al-wujud? I don't know how to translate it.
That one will come to next month, inshallah.
Oh, that's
because wajib al-wujud comes from the proof of imkan al-wujud.
Oh,
okay, let's take it easy.
All right.
Argument by design. Burhan of Naz. You know what the purpose is. Now, let me just give you a couple of minutes. Why don't you draw up a syllogism for me where the conclusion goes this way? Here's the conclusion. The universe has a sentient creator, or something like that. All you have to do is come up with a minor premise and a major premise for me. Remember, they both have to be valid, and they have to be in the right form as well. Shouldn't be too hard. If you've got one in your mind, just blurt it out.
You're looking for minor?
I'm looking for a minor premise and a major premise, you know, both of which are valid, in the right form that I can come to the conclusion. Because look, if you come up with a major premise that is true, and a minor premise that is true, and they're put into the right form, nobody can escape from the conclusion. Whether you like it or not, you've got to accept the conclusion. If you don't accept the conclusion, not only do you question your belief in the existence of God, a person has to question his belief in anything and everything. Right?
Yes, say the world.
Every system needs intelligent designer. Every intelligent system needs intelligent creation.
Okay.
And the world is intelligent creation.
Okay, so the world is, the universe is, I'll make it easier for you. You kind of got the order flipped, but we'll start with the minor premise. This is known as the Sughra, this is known as the Kubra. The Kubra is usually a Kulli, it's a general statement. So the every will come here, all right? Every human is mortal, for example, right? The every will come here, but here, the universe is what?
Is intelligent or...
Don't try to use loaded words. Try to use a little simpler words. Because then you have, you know, you use the word intelligent over here, and then you use the word intelligent over here, and it doubles up, and, you know, it becomes circular at a while.
Harmonized?
Okay, let's just say it's a design structure. Or has... I'm going to give you a simpler form. Let's start with a simpler form of the argument. You will see that the simpler form does run you at some point into trouble. We'll give you the more, subtle form of the argument. The universe has design structures. Okay? Every
structure.
Well, this is going to come here.
Every design structure.
Every design structure.
Need designer.
Good. Needs a
designer.
Sentient. Designer or creator, whatever it is. The conclusion, the universe has a sentient creator. The form of the argument, as you can see, obviously is valid. One third of the work is done. This is beautiful because all I have to do is to prove the minor premise and to prove the major premise, and nobody can escape from that argument. It's also beautiful to have this in your mind. Because sometimes you're talking to somebody and they have an objection to the existence of God. If you know what the argument is, you quickly come to realize this person's objection, is it in the major premise? Or this person's objection, is it in the minor premise? Which premise they haven't understood. But unless you have this structure in your mind, you really cannot appreciate what the other person is trying to argue. All right. So one third of our job is done. All that's left is to prove this and to prove this. All right, I'm going to go quickly through that because what I want to do today is I want to come to David Hume's argument. All right, let's start with the minor premise, the universe has design structures. Now, of course, you'll show me that, look, there's so many design structures in the universe, which is correct. But tell me one thing, what's a design structure? How do you define it? What's the difference between a design structure and a non-design structure?
System, all of the components of the system are matched together and follow up the aim.
All the components have a meaningful relation to each other.
Just keep this in mind. What you're saying is correct. Multiple components, right? You just can't have one thing, right? Mm-hmm. Can't just be like a rock or something. A rock is even multiple components in itself, but you know, can't be a simple thing. Working together. For a
purpose,
for an aim. That's why it's called the teleological argument, the argument by design, or rather the argument by purpose, that there is a purpose to everything that we see around us for a purpose. So, for example, when you look at a clock is a design structure because there are multiple components, yes. Do they work with each other? Yes. For a purpose? Yes, and the purpose is to tell time, for example. Now, when you look at the world around us, do you see design structures? Nobody can deny that you see design structures. You don't even have to look at the world around you. You just have to look within yourself. You look at your eye, you look at your ear, you look at your heart, you look at your body as a whole. These are all design structures. You look at the eye, multiple components, starting from the outside of the eye, going to the lens, the cornea, looking at the retina, the cones, the rods, everything put together, the electrical impulses, or the, you know, the optical impulses, the way they're converted into electrical impulses, going into your brain, multiple components, definitely multiple components, working together, well, definitely working together. For a particular purpose, yes, of course, the purpose is to be able to see, right? The same with the ear, the same with the rest of the body, the same with the forest, for example, the same with the solar system, multiple components, you know, working together in tandem for the purpose of, you know, subsisting life, for example, or, you know, making sure there is the sun and then there's the earth and the two don't, for example, collapse into each other. All right, so the universe has design structures. There's no doubt about that. that the universe has design structures. Every design structure needs a sentient designer. Right? Now, at first, this seems self-evident. I remember a hadith where somebody came to the sixth imam and said, prove to me the existence of God. And the sixth imam said to him, you see that boat that's over there? Let me tell you a story of how it came into being. The way it came into being.